I think when you talk of complications, there are two dimensions. I think the first for me is the complications within Afghanistan. We now have a new regime, the Taliban, back after 20 years. We know that the previous version of the Taliban were very restrictive, some would say even radical, over political and social space. That the Taliban, even then, even before they were overthrown by the US-backed Northern Alliance, did not have legitimacy across the country. We know that now they still have not formed a government, they still have not established a leadership, that their local units in different parts of the country may be operating on their own, which is why we hear reports of beatings and detentions and even executions. So there are all these complications about the future for almost 40 million Afghans. Then the second set of complications really is kind of referred to in a way from a U.S. perspective in recent days, which is the notion that with the airport attack by Islamic State Kandahar, which killed more than 160 Afghans and 13 U.S. troops, there is this second war on terror. You know, the first war on terror was after 9/11. Now we have a war on terror supposedly on ISIS-K. But this doesn't solve the complications to just declare a war on terror because the U.S. no longer has assets within Afghanistan. It withdrew. It doesn't have people on the ground. It doesn't have groups on the ground with whom it has been working. So that raises the prospect that for this complication, what we might call the war on terror, the United States, far from challenging the Taliban, may wind up cooperating with it. Because if you need information about ISIS-K, if you need to identify ISIS-K.
They have to rely on Taliban sources, is that?
Absolutely. You know, the Taliban first and foremost, except maybe in a specific area, say like the Panjshir Valley, which is where you have the leading resistance to Taliban, Mr. Massoud's group. But I think even this war on terror, beyond no boots on the ground, there's a further almost distraction, which also makes me question it, which is there has not been a significant attack by an Islamic State cell in Europe or the United States since 2017. We've had some so-called lone wolf attacks where people may have used guns or knives in the name of Islamic State, but there really hasn't been an organized operation on the scale that we saw, for example, in Paris several years ago, indeed, that we have seen in London several years ago. If there's been, as it were, terrorism, that terrorism has been more in the region, that we're talking about various groups, not just Al-Qaeda, but were groups that came out of Pakistan that had carried out terrorist attacks in India, for example. And indeed, ISIS-K, which was founded in 2015, it's a very small group, only a few thousand members, has always been a regional group. So I have a feeling that in this framing, if it comes from a US point of view, or even a UK or maybe European point of view, we don't appreciate both what is happening within Afghanistan and what is happening within the region. But I have to be honest with you, for domestic politics, given the difficulty that Joe Biden is in, it's easier to declare ISIS-K as a global enemy and hope to recover some ground after not only the U.S. withdrawal, but of course the loss of those 13 U.S. troops last week.
U.S. have to speak directly to the Taliban. The head of the CIA talked directly last week in Kabul with the Taliban. So, because we have another problem, how can a Taliban-ruled economy can survive without, for example, the foreign aid, the IMF? Is it China and Russia time on this one in Kabul?
The U.S. has been in direct talks with the Taliban for some time. Go back to 2019 and the start of what is known as, you know, the Doha process, these political talks in Qatar. And indeed, the U.S. and Taliban agreed at the start of 2020, under the Trump administration, for a process leading to U.S. withdrawal. It did not just start with Joe Biden. But the second phase of those direct talks have occurred, of course, as the Taliban approached and came into Kabul, where the U.S., you know, agreed with the Taliban, okay, don't attack embassies, allow the evacuation zone from the airport. And as you mentioned, those talks even included the CIA head flying to Kabul to meet the political head of the Taliban, Mullah Baradar. But it's this third phase that we're in now, which is, okay, if the U.S. is looking at the Taliban for, quote, security versus ISIS-K, what price does it pay? Or what is the leverage the Taliban have? And you were right. The leverage would be for the Taliban to say, if you want us to work with you or help you, you have to unfreeze the Afghan assets, almost $9.5 billion that are held overseas. You have to allow the International Monetary Fund to renew aid and to allow other assistance into the country, and then we'll work with you. Or maybe even, if this continues for months or even years, the Taliban say, well, if you want to work with us, you have to recognize us. You know, there has to be diplomatic relations for the first time. And as you note, there are other players that are in this. I think, you know, China is very much linked with Pakistan, developing this Belt and Road Initiative, the economic and political position through Asia. And of course, Pakistan is close to the Taliban. Russia would like to get back into the Afghanistan, and, you know, after being expelled as the Soviet Union in the 1980s. So I think the best way of thinking about this is almost as a kaleidoscope. There are different pieces and patterns. And the pattern that we have had in the past, which is simplistic, U.S. versus Taliban, that is not what we have now. The Taliban is a big piece. The U.S. is a piece, but it's kind of off to the side. I think we're looking at developments now being very much what happens within Afghanistan and within the region, and the U.S. trying to have some type of influence after, being honest with you, giving up that influence in recent months.